Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Food and Psych podcast, where I, Kimberly Wilson, chartered psychologist and food producer, take you through all things food and psychology. As well as looking at the way that food affects the structure and function of the brain, we'll also be thinking about the meaning of food in society and the role that it plays in people's lives. And my guest today is Gavin Knox. Gavin is a man of many pseudonyms. He has a baking blog and business as Mr. Mums and also answers to The Bearded Baker. In 2014, he won the Observer Food Monthly Award Reader's Recipe Prize for the Smoking Pig Liquor Brownies, a spiced chocolate brownie topped with dark chocolate dipped bacon. And yes, I will include a link to the recipe for you in the show notes on the website. 5 years ago, Gavin and his husband adopted two children, siblings aged 4 and 5. In this conversation, we talk about his experience of becoming a father, including the challenges and the triumphs, and how food is a way to build family traditions with his children. Just a quick note, usually when I'm asking someone about their food story in these Breaking Bread episodes, I'm in their kitchen. However, Gavin recently moved to Toronto, Canada, and the commute is a little bit tricky. So this conversation was conducted via Skype. And what we did was I baked his recipe in advance in my own kitchen so that we were still, if only virtually, breaking bread together. This also means that the sound might not be crystal clear in places. I think it's pretty good, and that's mostly because Sarah, who does the technical bits for the sound on the podcast, is a genius. But if it gets sketchy, please do be patient. It should only last for a second or two, and I really felt that it was important to get this conversation and this perspective out there. So I'm really grateful for your patience on that. And with that said, here's my conversation about brownies, identity, and modern family life with Gavin Knox. When people come onto the podcast, and thank you very much for agreeing to be here today, or not here, but we'll go into that in a moment. I ask people to make something that is meaningful to them. So it doesn't have to represent their culture or anything like that. It can just be the cheese on toast they have when they get home at the end of the day. But tell me about the recipe that you have selected.
So the recipe I selected is a recipe called Smoking Pig Liquor Brownies. Uh-huh. And I know they sound extremely weird, but basically they're pretty typical of my style of cooking. And they're based on an American kind of street fair fate treat called a pig liquor, mm-hmm. which is a rind of crispy bacon, which is crisp, not deep fried, and then dipped in chocolate, and then normally dipped in either salt or crushed up nuts. And then this is the inspiration that I used for these brownies. So the brownies themselves are a chocolate and chili based brownie with bacon pieces mixed through it, and then each are topped with a piece of this pig liquor, the chocolate dipped bacon.
Mm-hmm. And so these are the American fairs where kind of you can get anything fried type things.
Yeah, pretty much. If it sits still, it's going to be fried. So, you know, you're talking corn dogs. Yeah, basically anything is, you know, I'm sure there's some stalls there where anything can be deep fried and put on a stick.
And you said that this is representative of your style of cooking. What do you mean by that?
I like to play around with things and push the envelope on them with an ingredient so that there's a slightly outside of the box way of thinking about it, slightly irreverent, way of thinking about it, you know, kind of tampering with traditions, but that's me.
I concur with that. That's very similar to me, I think. I like to think of myself as having a healthy disregard for tradition. Why do you think, or what is it, do you think that that kind of style reflects in other parts of your life as well? Do you think that this revoking of tradition or trying to test things and be different also plays out in other parts of your life?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, as a gay man, you can't really get any more breaking tradition than that. You know, and adding to the mix there as well, a gay dad on top of that, it's kind of staring tradition in the face and flipping the bird, really. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah, absolutely, that's fine. How do you feel that your lifestyle is a kind of flipping of tradition?
I think it's kind of a twofold aspect in that, you know, the societal norms of what a family should be, where, you know, a mum, a dad, and the 2.4 children is one aspect of it. You know, we're a gay couple, we've been together quite a long time, and we've had our kids now for, it will be 5 years this year. So that kind of breaks the mold in the sense of, you know, that kind of cliched and old-fashioned stereotypical view of gay men as just the party guys. But also it kind of, I suppose it breaks the mold to some people in the gay community as well, in that we're not just settling for that. We've kind of gone and, you know, sometimes we've had people have the reaction that we've almost sold out trying to be heteronormative, in the sense of, you know, you're just trying to imitate what society accepts as a normal, happy couple.
Oh, really?
Using the dreaded N-word in the sense of, you know, being heteronormative, normal. You're trying to have the 2.4 kids, the two cats, and, you know, basically almost be a Stepford wife almost. So it's kind of going in the face of tradition from both sides of the mirror, really.
And that's, I'm surprised to hear that because, you know, from an outside of you, my sense is of the LGBT community really pushing for all kinds of equality across the spectrum, whether it's marriage equality, family equality, work life, social life. And of course, you know, I hear what you're saying, that it's not everyone, but I suppose it's news to me that there might be some sense in which having children, for some members of the LGBT community, having children is what straight couples do, and it's not for the LGBT community.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's almost like, you know, the individuals or the instances where this happened are, they're trying to cling on to what makes them different in the pursuit of trying to actually pursue that equality. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that doesn't really make sense, but it's almost like a bizarre paradox.
And how did you and your husband kind of reconcile that? I mean, were you surprised? Did you laugh it off? Did you have discussions about it? How did you make sense of those different responses to your choice to have children?
Well, we had discussions about it, but to be honest, I think both of us now, we're in our 40s, and our opinion on things is, well, if that's your take on life, that's exactly what it is. It's your take on life. This is ours. We're happy doing what we're doing. This is what we wanted to do. And we kind of don't need to be quantified by other people's opinions on whether we're doing the right or the wrong thing. You're always going to have an opinion from somebody else who's different to yours and who doesn't quite get what you're doing or doesn't quite get, you know, your aspect and your take on it. You know, kind of, I guess, kind of similar to the way I bake. Some people don't kind of get why I use those flavor combinations, but, you know, I do it because that's my thing.
The you be you, yeah?
Yeah.
Did you get any of that from the straight community, or was that a different?
It's slightly different in the sense that because the straight community is, I suppose, more prevalent, the response there has mostly been, on the whole, a sense of admiration. Which is a bit like, oh my God, you're adopting kids, that's wonderful, you know, you're great, you're fantastic. Which, the first few times you do end up going, okay, thanks for saying that. And then you end up thinking, well, you know, that's not the only reason we've done this. You know, it wasn't just to be martyrs to the cause or be saints. We actually had a purpose in that. We wanted a family. That's why we did it. But there are sometimes, and I probably spot this and see this a bit more than my husband, because I would be the stay-at-home dad with the kids. be around them or outside, there is almost an underlying current of, how would I say, maybe side-eyeing in the sense of, okay, you're a dad, you're not doing it the right way. And that, surprisingly, comes mostly from mums.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's almost like they feel they have the right to comment and to have an opinion and to try and show you the ways. I remember distinctly there was a case where I was in a McDonald's with the kids. They were off school and it was a treat. And some woman actually came up to me, a complete stranger, and started lecturing me on how I should be with my kids and how I should feed them.
Oh my.
And it left me a little bit flabbergasted in the sense of, oh my God, what do you think gives you the right to actually do that to a complete stranger?
Mm.
There are other kind of, I suppose, social nuances where you get asked, oh, well, you know, when is mom going to be here? Or what does your mom do in this situation? And they would be addressed to the kids and not to me. And that's where I kind of have to step in and go, actually, you know what? I, in this case, would be the mom. Mm-hmm. But actually, I'm the dad, and there is another dad as well. And you can kind of see the look of, oh, I've stepped over the line a bit. And sometimes that's what it is. There is a look of genuine shock, which I suppose says a lot more about society itself rather than the individual. That there's almost this kind of automatic assumption that if there are kids, there will be a mom and a dad.
Sure,
There were similar situations when we were actually moving over here to Toronto, coming through passport control and immigration. And my husband had come over here first because he had started a job for us, and I was coming up with the kids. And going through passport control, the question always out of, I think it must be about three or four of the authorities there were, so where's mom then?
Mm.
And that was where I ended up just kind of going, well, dad is already in the country, I'm the other dad, and do you need to see any papers? And it wasn't that they were quizzing for papers, it was just that automatic response, that automatic question.
The automatic assumption about what a family looks like.
That stereotypical image.
How have you navigated that with your children? Because, you know, they came from the biological family with both their parents to this new family, which is headed by two men. How have you tried to prepare them for other people's ideas about what that's like?
Well, that's actually quite topical at the moment, because up until recently, it was pretty much taken as writ with them, so they had two dads, big deal. You know, that's just another alternative family structure. Because we had certain books around the house that we used to read with them and give them, you know, just leave lying around for them to look at, which were about different family structures and the different ways they could be made up. But now that one of our kids is heading into tweenage years and the hormones are starting to kick in, there's more influence externally coming in from our friends, from TV, from just from general environments around her, as to this is what a more common family structure is. Mm-hmm. And that's led to them kind of questioning ours and being a bit embarrassed about it or reluctant to actually acknowledge it to their friends. So we've gone down the route of actually, you know, leaving certain books around the house, so kids' LGBT history, books on kind of positive reinforcement of that family structure and of LGBT environments and communities. Because, you know, with kids, you can try to ram it down their throats and sit them down and give them lectures. But after 10, 15 minutes, they're just going to zone out. Whereas what we have found to be more productive and actually more long-term is just to treat it more as an everyday environment for them and an everyday positive environment. The other thing is that here in Canada at the moment, it's also Pride Month. June is Pride Month. So there's a lot of activities and a lot of events going on around which aren't just spearheaded, aren't just for the older gay community or the grown-up gay community. There's also family pride events. We've actually got one this weekend that we're going to, where it's just a lot more easy for the kids to get into and to accept and to just kind of go, well, you know what, it's not actually that unusual. You know, there's this whole playground full of kids and they've got, you know, two dads, two moms, they've got two moms and a dad. You know, there's lots of different family structures there that they get to see on their terms, which for them is a lot easier for them to accept.
You adopted your children, and you adopted quite older children. How old were they when you adopted them?
They were 4 and 5, which, you know, in the grand scheme of things, doesn't actually sound that old. Mm. But in the whole spectrum of the adoption process, they are termed as older kids. Most people, when you talk to them about adoption, have the cliched image of babies. Mm. And I think most people, when they go into the adoption process, the usual kind of parameters that they work to are babies up to about 18 months. So yeah, ours were termed older kids at 4 and 5. And to add into the mix again, they were a couple, so we adopted them together. Which for them, kind of, again, in the adoption process, the odds were stacked against is, as I said, most people go into it looking for a baby up to 18 months and just the one. So we decided to go for older kids and a couple, and that's something we decided from the outset.
And why is that? Why?
For us, I suppose you could take the look on it that it was being somewhat selfish, in that we wanted to have as much engagement with the kids as soon as possible. So we would be able to recognize some of their characters and individuals straight away. But also on the kind of, I suppose, the logistical side of things, there's a rather kind of interesting catch-22 with adopted kids. That's the earlier you get them, there's less question about emotional difficulties because you can form the attachments quicker. Mm-hmm. But there's more of a question about the developmental, because, of course, they're still babies. The brain and everything else hasn't finished developed, so you don't know if there's any damage there from when they were younger with the birth family. Mm-hmm. But the catch-22 is with older kids, there's less developmental issues because they're older, things have developed and it's more apparent, but you have more emotional work to do in trying to form those attachment bonds and trying to, in essence, rewire their emotions.
Yeah, and I think that's a very poignant point to make, because as a psychologist, I know that some of the reasons that adoptions of older children don't work is because there's a real difficulty for the parents in trying to, A, adapt to the child, but also for the children to, especially if they come from difficult backgrounds, which presumably most of them have, for the children to try to adapt into this new family, into this new dynamic, into different relationships and different qualities of relationships, as well as mourning the loss of their birth family, whatever happened in those circumstances. How prepared did you and your husband feel for that? How was that experience?
To be honest, I don't think that's particular to adoptive parents in the sense that, you know, parenthood is going to be a steep learning curve. The whole grief process, as I've come to call it, is, you know, something you can't really prepare for, because every kid and everyone is individual themselves, so it's how they handle them. Some kids will just kind of, you know, put it to the back of their head and go, no, everything's fine, everything's okay, there's no problems. Other kids will be much more hard on their sleeves about it and be very apparent what they're feeling, what they're doing. But I think for me in particular, and me going through adoption processes and then, you know, coming out the other side as an adopted dad, there's also what I've come to realize is it's not just, I suppose, a grieving process on the part of the kids, it's also your own grieving process, because you go into the adoption process with this picture perfect ideal of what your new kids are going to be like, you know, and how you're going to have, you know, these great bonding moments and do this, and go to this team or go to this park and do this way. But of course, when they arrive, they're a completely other individual. Mm. And you have to kind of accept that and kind of park the whole picture-perfect notion and go, well, you know, it's not really like that. And that's in no way dismissing the kids in these scenarios. It's a learning curve, and not just in the sense of, you know, all of a sudden you have these children and you're going, oh my God, what do I do? It's kind of things that kick in bit by bit, and some days rather than other days. And yeah, it's also a case of, I suppose, getting used to the whole fact that all of a sudden, you know, in our case, we have two other individuals that we have to factor into our lives. We can't just do as our routine was before, or We can't do things at the drop of a hat. We have to kind of plan things a bit more and take into account whether things are suitable for them, whether they're not suitable for them, whether they'd be interested. I mean, that's a whole minefield there, you know, trying to retain their interest longer than half an hour. Otherwise, you've got two bored kids, and then the squabbling starts, and then it's downhill from there.
And how was your transition from, not a single man, but, you know, a man without children, to very quickly having a family? How did you find that transition?
Very steep learning curve, extremely. For about the first month, myself and my husband did still look at each other and kind of go, oh my God, we're dads, what have we done? It's all because you can't really quantify and say that, you know, oh, it was one day I was in a couple and it was just two of us, and then the next day there was four of us and it was all fine. You learn things bit by bit, and you have to learn them fast. You have to pick up on, as I said, these new individuals' quirks and their idiosyncrasies and what they're about. And there is a whole period which lasts quite a long time, of almost second-guessing yourself, where you're left wondering, you know, are they behaving like this because they're kids, and because they're this age, and this is what a kid this age does, or is it a sign of some underlying issue? Is this an iceberg that's going to come out? But for us now, as I said, we've had the kids for 5 years. We went through that phase, and my advice to anyone who is in that position, adoptive or otherwise, is to kind of abandon the whole process of reading, you know, this book, that book, looking at this study, taking this chat forum, and just do what you feel is right. You know, you're a parent, you're a sensible grown-up person, or at least I would hope you are. And if it's not right in your gut, then it's generally not right for you as a family unit.
And I think you make a really important point about the giving up of fantasy, about the idealistic idea of how anything's going to be. And I think that counts for, well, not just parents. I think it counts for parents, adoptive parents, biological parents. But I think it also applies in daily life as well, that we can hold on to these idealized views of how things are going to be. And when they don't, it can create a lot of pain and distress if we're still holding on to the idealized image. And if we can't really sit down and face the reality of how the situation is.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you have to kind of, you know, for as we're kind of bordering on there, saying go through the whole grieving process and then lay it at rest. The longer you try and hold on to it and, you know, try actually set it in motion, the more frustrating it is. And especially in the case with, you know, in our case with adopted kids, if that were the scenario, I would end up spending most of my time trying to achieve something that just can't be achieved, and miss everything else that's going on around me. You know, before I know it, the kids will be growing up and out the door, and I'd kind of be sat there wondering, well, A, how did that happen so quick? And B, I still haven't really achieved anything.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
thinking about that transition that your children made from their original family, and then presumably they were in care in the care system for a little while before you met them and before they became your children, how important for you was it to put some traditions in place to kind of help them to understand that this was now their family, that they belonged here?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we were quite lucky in the sense that they didn't have that many foster placements before they arrived with us. They'd only had two, which is quite low on the adoption system.
It is.
But for us, both of us, as a couple before we became adoptive parents, had strong traditions. Even down to just the frivolous things like Eurovision. We would always have a Eurovision party with friends over. Christmas is huge in our house. It's not just a week of Christmas, it's month long. Although we have actually started, sometimes shifted in November in order to facilitate friends visiting. But yeah, it's not, placing stuff like that in the home for us isn't just about, you know, establishing the tradition. It also has the comfort aspect for the kids, especially coming from care. You know, one of the things we learned quickly about it was having those traditions and anchor points in place, and also having the boundaries in place. Because even though it might sound constraining and a bit rigorous for the kids, it actually gives them that sense of comfort in that this is where I belong, this is my area.
Yeah.
And the stuff like, as I said, the tradition of Christmas is really important to the house, and the kids now know that, and they will come to us and say, oh, it's December the 1st, are we going to turn on the Christmas lights? And then it's followed by, are we going to do the Christmas cookies? How are we going to decorate the Christmas cookies? So even though, I suppose, from a grown-up point of view, it might seem like the little things, for them, they are these, you know, they're the steady building blocks that they can actually hold on to, especially given their start in life.
Well, I completely agree. And those, the reliability and stability is what creates trust, isn't it? That we learn to trust people not from what they say, but from the consistency of their actions. And so those traditions will be embedding, I think, I'm certain, in your children. And it was nice to hear that there are Christmas cookies. Is food part of the tradition in your family? Do you cook together?
Now that the kids are getting a bit older, they're starting to actually help out more in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, there was this whole period of, well, do I let them in the kitchen? Because there's a hot stove, there's an oven, there's, you know, a KitchenAid blade whirring around.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not so much a case that they would cook stuff by themselves with me watching them. I'd actually get them to help out on certain aspects. One of the first things I've started making with them is just simple as bread.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of joy they actually get out of that is, you know, maybe it's just me being old and cynical. To me, it's kind of like, wow, I didn't realize that meant that much to you. And you know, there's none of this KitchenAid nonsense. We don't use a dough hook. If you get in there, you start kneading. You knead for 10 minutes, which at the start was a little bit hard, because of course after 3 minutes it's a bit like, no, my arms are so
it's quite tiring. Yes.
But that's where, I suppose, for me, I handle that in the sense of, well, okay, you can stop now, but it won't work out right. You know, you won't get a proper loaf of bread. Do you still want to stop? And the first time they were stopping, I was going, okay, fine, we'll see what happens. So we would make it, and of course it wouldn't turn out right.
Mm-hmm.
So it also kind of serves that aspect of, I suppose, teaching life lessons, in the sense of you get out of things what you put into them. But yeah, I've started baking with them and cooking with them a lot more. And for them, they get immense joy, pleasure, whatever word you want to use, I think, out of that aspect of interaction with me on that front, because they know the kitchen is my domain.
Mm-hmm.
And for them, being in the kitchen is interacting not only with the food, not only with the appliances, but also with me on my level.
Mm-hmm.
We've developed that, an understanding on that kind of level, on that kind of camaraderie as well.
There are so many points in that I want to pick up on, and it's great that, and the first one is how food and cooking and that shared experience in the kitchen can serve so many other functions than just purely getting something on a plate for dinner. That within that, there's the opportunity to teach patience, to teach process, to teach concentration, all of those subtle soft skills that really do translate into other parts of life. And it's not just about the function of it, but everything that happens in between. And of course, on top of that, they get that time with you, which is not, you know, you being in dad mode where go and clean up your room or do your homework and that kind of, but in this shared act of, I guess, creation of and also of play, that we can do something together. We have a shared endeavor. And I think those sorts of things are enormously important. It puts me also in mind of the marshmallow experiment. Did you know that one? It's really a test of how able a child is to delay gratification. So the original study got a group of, I think, 4 and 5 year olds, and they put them in a classroom and they were instructed, like they said, hey, here's a marshmallow. I'm going to pop outside for a few minutes. If you don't eat the marshmallow, when I come back, you'll get 2. And so, right. So this was really testing how able the children were to delay gratification. You know, if I wait, I'll get 2 marshmallows. Yeah. If I eat it now, I'll just get 1. And this skill is really linked to lots of other qualities in older life. So people who are able to delay gratification tend to do better in school. They tend to get better jobs. They tend to have higher achievement because they're able to work towards a goal. There's lots of thinking about how we can teach that to children. And certainly I think baking and baking bread is almost a perfect one because there's a lot of waiting around.
watching the proverbial, you know, boiling kettle, if you like.
Yeah. No, I think that's...
That's particularly worked good in our case because one of our kids does have a little bit of an issue with kind of, you know, sticking with things for the long run until it comes to fruition. But again, it's one of those aspects where you think, well, are they like that because they're a kid, or are they like that because they have a problem with delaying gratification? Mm. You know, it's kind of like they just want to skip all the bits in between and get to the end. And gradually through the whole making process and the waiting around and the proving and even the, you know, 20, 30 minutes out to the oven, mm-hmm. we've seen that kind of attention span, if you like, has been lengthened and been drawn out a bit more. So that element of patience has actually come in a lot more, which is a really great thing to see.
You're Irish by heritage, and... There was the gay marriage referendum in 2015, and now Ireland is set to have its first gay immigrant president, which is incredible. Yeah. So what are your thoughts on what's happening in the broader landscape?
I'll start with the Ireland thing. Mm. I find it amazing. One of the reasons I actually left Ireland is at the time when, and at the age I was at, I just kind of thought that there wasn't going to be, I would never get the life I wanted, so I wouldn't get to marry somebody, or I certainly wouldn't get to have kids there. And it's quite a turnaround to see that, A, Ireland has become a country who, by public vote, has taken on equal marriage rights. And now that, you know, their head politician, the Taoiseach, or basically the equivalent of a prime minister, is going to be a gay man from mixed heritage background.
From what I see, you have this real split down the middle between great strides being made in Canada, in Ireland, across the world, in one direction, and also on the other side, this increase or this greater highlighting of the targeting of gay men, for example, in Chechnya, and the countries across Africa and the Middle East and the West Indies where gay relationships are still punishable by either prison or the death sentence. And it's an extraordinary state of affairs that these two experiences can be going on side by side.
Yeah, I think what maybe strengthened that kind of view and that opinion, because you are completely correct in that, is, you know, nowadays we have social media, we have the internet, so there is a lot more coverage of things ad hoc. It's not just the press reporting on it. It's, you know, mobile phone footage or people posting on their pages about it. But also I think in the sense that most of where the strides have been made in the LGBT community is in the slightly more developed world, but also in the sense of, I suppose, what's more accepted as the gay society. So your typical gay white males, there is still a lot of issues going on with trans people, in the LGBT community with people of colour in the LGBT community. You know, the whole thing of Pulse is one factor of that. It was a predominantly Latinx environment there. And then, as you said, you have areas like Chechnya where you have these reports coming out of the camps, and you know, the people in power just don't seem to be doing anything about it. I think it's been addressed twice by two world politicians, and that's as far as it's gone. There has been no kind of concrete action given on it, or they haven't done anything about it. It's still kind of going on. And of course, there's been all the reports of gay men being thrown off buildings because it's just not acceptable. But that's all it seems to be. You have the general public and the LGBT community up in arms about it, saying something should be done, but just doesn't seem to be anything being done. There actually is an organization within Toronto here called Rainbow Railroad, who I think have, their latest is they've managed to kind of get three gay men out of Chechnya.
Wow.
What they do is they go in and basically rescue people in threatening areas and will take them out and set them up as best as possible. On the whole and the broader spectrum, there is immense work to be done, I think, in areas like that, but it doesn't mean there isn't any work being done. Sorry, I realise that might be a slightly convoluted way of answering.
No, but it's a complex question, you know, and there's a sense of outrage, but also, I guess, helplessness as well, certainly what I feel. Because, I mean, I watched a video of the Russian foreign minister just really ignoring this and talking it down and taking quite a cold response to a reporter's questions about what the hell is going on. And it's quite frightening. And I think it leaves people feeling particularly powerless about what to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're left watching those videos, or I can only imagine what it's like being in the audience. They're trying to get, you know, a somewhat concrete answer, a somewhat productive answer out of those people, when all they seem to be doing is putting up these walls in front of you, or just literally going, no, we're not going to answer that. You know, there is that inherent sense of frustration and helplessness. You know, for me, it's twofold, I would have to say, in some respects, that it's not only for me as a gay man with a husband, but now as a gay dad, you know, there's the fact of, well, what kind of world are my kids actually growing up into? Because you do, as cliche as it sounds, you do end up having that view in your head of the actions and the things that are going on now. We might feel some effects of them, but the long-term effects are what the generations after us will feel. And as a parent, whether you're a gay parent or a straight parent, that has a massive impact on your way of thinking and how you perceive things.
Does it frighten you?
I wouldn't say frightened. It bothers me. It's that kind of, it's that sort of Damocles kind of hanging over things. You know, you, as you mentioned there, you look in some areas and you see massive strides being made in equal rights, but then you look at others and it's almost the pendulum is swinging the opposite way, and the opposite way into a very dark area. So it's not something you can just kind of brush over and go, oh well, that's what's happening there. And I also think that's an impact of what happened in Orlando with the Pulse shooting, in that although it was, you know, miles away, someplace I've never been, you still end up feeling an effect of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just something you can't just go, oh, it's a news report and that's it. You know, carry on with your day. You do have it hanging over. You do have it niggling in the back of your mind.
Accepting that we can't change the world in one podcast. but
who knows? Power to the people.
What could people do, whether that's just the person on, you know, just the lay person, the person on the street, that would improve things for you or for, say, gay parents? What do you think would be a valuable approach?
Wow, that's a question and a half.
Even if that's an ideal world scenario.
I think, actually, and this is going to sound really, really corny, but I think just love a little bit more. So it's four letters, L-O-V-E. And I don't mean that in the really corny sense of rushing out and throwing your arms around everybody and, you know, hugs, kisses, and kumbaya. I mean it in the sense that love isn't easy. You've got to learn to see past differences and see past discrepancies and hang on in there. It's a bit like you were saying earlier about the delayed gratification. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to hang on in for the long journey. And initially, you know, people meeting other people, other LGBT people in the world may not like them, may not like their lifestyles or their views or their opinions, but there's more to that person than those opinions and views. And it's actually pushing through that and saying, you know what, I don't agree with you. I don't agree with your views, but you go your way, I'll go mine, and we'll still, let's all do our thing and get along. I think holding on to that animosity and letting it fester and grow and just kind of be ever present is not going to move things forward. It's not going to be productive, both for our generation and you know, grown ups, but also for kids. You know, at the end of the day, kids learn by imitation, and they can only do what they see as being acceptable or what they see as acceptable in society.
So patience and openness, I think, seems to be what you're saying. Yeah. No, I think that's an important ask for anyone. And so that's exactly why I want to do this podcast. It's about really using our shared experience of food and eating to understand individual perspectives, that there's something else going on, and that if we just put down our differences for a moment, even if it's just to hear somebody else's story, that we'll find aspects of ourselves in other people and realize that we, and again, yes, it does sound a bit corny, but that we do have more in common.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there was, just picking up on that whole thing I was just saying, you know, food and putting down our differences, there was a really great TV ad run here by one of the major Canadian food stores. And basically the setting was in an apartment block, lots of residences in there, and somebody decided to set up a table in the middle of the corridor and start eating there. And then one of the neighbors came out, they brought some food, more neighbors came out, but they were all from different backgrounds. So you had Canadians there, you had French people there, you had gay people there, you had Muslims there, it was a complete mix of people. But the whole point of them doing this ad, and yes, it is advertising at the end of the day, was just to show that food and eating can actually bring people together. You know, once you park the differences and the issues at the door, get in there and have some, dare I say, some good grub, you know, you'll be amazed at what can actually happen and the wonders that can be on the table, and not just in a food sense.
Yeah, and that's beautiful. And yes, exactly that irrespective of how different we might be in terms of background, we all have to eat. And that's why these episodes where I talk to people are called Breaking Bread. And the idea is about coming together and sharing something over food. You sent me your recipe in advance, right? I got it in advance. And because we can't be together in person, I have made your brownie and I have it sitting here in front of me. And I've been very, very patient because I didn't even taste a sample before we got talking. So I'm going to give it a go now.
Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, that's very clever. I don't know, people aren't going to find me eating very interesting, but it picks up on that salted caramel theme, doesn't it? That lovely salty umami flavours mixed with the richness of the chocolate.
It's a clash of sweet versus salty, and which I think is more prevalent over, now that I'm over in this side of the border in North America than it is in the UK. I think in the UK it just kind of took it as far as salted caramel. And that was it, really. Well, it did when I was living there. Mm-hmm. But it got to a point where there was salted caramel with everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what I wanted to do there was just add in, you know, a different take on it, in the sense that it's not just using caramel, but it is using that, you know, the whole umami aspect versus the sweet of the chocolate. And like I said, it's a whole play on the... I kind of imagine it coming from a trip to, as I said, one of these American carnivals or American fates, where you've got, you know, the smokers and the barbecues there, the chili cook-offs, and just trying to mash all that up into the one thing. And brownies for me, you know, I've got a hell of a sweet tooth, and that was a good place to start for me. And yeah, the interesting thing about the actual recipe itself was that when I originally tried it, it was the feedback from a couple of people was, no, this is not good. You can't have bacon in sweet things. It just doesn't work. It's, forget about it. But I pursued it, carried on through it, experimented. I ate a lot of them, all in the course of research.
Of course.
Lo and behold, it basically became my calling card, or it was what I became kind of known for, and it's where, I started my whole online social persona with. So it was a big kind of feather in my cap, for lack of a better word.
And not just that, not just that it tastes good and did well, but you won the Observer Food Monthly Readers Award for it.
Way back when. that was actually, I suppose for me as a home baker, it was the first time where, I got recognition from complete strangers, but also complete strangers who were, in essence, gods in the culinary world, because the whole process of the Observer Food Awards is that your recipe is submitted, it's cooked in a test kitchen, and that's the first test, whether it can actually be cooked and whether the people can follow your recipe. But then it's also submitted to a judging panel. And the year I was doing it, you had the likes of Nigel Slater, Jay Rayner, Heston Blumenthal. So to actually, sit down and think, oh my God, these people have tasted a recipe of mine and liked it. It is just like, wow.
Well, belated but heartfelt congratulations for you on that. No, that's great.
And thank you.
I will, of course.
I'm going to write that story for years, so don't worry about it.
Well, I'll link it in the show notes and also on the front page of the webpage for this podcast. So people will be able to download that. They'll be able to go straight to the webpage and be able to make your smoking pig liquor brownies for themselves.
And if they really want to laugh, they can read the comments on the original Guardian page.
I might have to check those out for myself.
Yeah, they're them. Yeah, just make sure you're not eating at the time. You might end up spitting it out.
So I think we've kind of covered everything. Life.
Awesome.
Life, food,
life,
your experiences, the world.
LGBT rights, brownies.
Is there anything else that you want to say before we go?
No.
Okay, in that case, can I say thank you so much, Gavin, for being here. Anyone who wants to follow Gavin, I'll put the links to his social accounts and you can find him on the internet. And I hope you enjoyed this conversation.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.